This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 259 was recorded on February 18th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole, and by SS&C EZ, delivering cutting-edge cloud, mobile, and on-premise solutions to optimize operational and investment alpha across the entire investment process. Listeners, Macro Voices has failed you again. We really do agree with all of you who have emailed and tweeted to us to say that we need to balance the recent series of secular inflationists with a good, solid, well-respected deflationist. Problem is, all the smartest macro guys and gals we know have turned into secular inflationists. And Louis Vincent Gav returns as this week's feature interview guest, and he says he's as inflationista as they come. We'll discuss why and how to trade the upcoming inflation. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when macro tourist blogger Kevin Muir joins us to discuss why he thinks investors need to understand the Treasury general account, and particularly why more than $1 trillion is going to flow out of it in the next couple of months. We'll discuss what the TGA is and why Kevin thinks it's about to transform from financial trivia that nobody cares about into what could potentially become the center of a crisis Kevin thinks everyone will care about.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump to that S&P 500. It's been a relatively flat week. I mean, more or less, 3,900 continues to gamma pin into the option expiration. But it really, the big question is there going to be some big volatility starting next week? What's your take on the S&P and where we go next?
No real change, Patrick. It's another week, another all-time high in the middle of a pandemic. I think this is all about a combination of secular inflation and stimulus expectations. And again, I certainly think at the same time, I do agree with the people who are saying these valuations are stretched to ridiculous limits. The thing is, they're saying it's a setup for a crash. I wouldn't be surprised if it's really a setup for a melt-up in the other direction. It's a crack-up boom in Austrian economics parlance. And like I've said before, I'm quite happy to be focused primarily on crude oil trading.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar because, more or less, we keep bouncing around the 90-91 level. And for all the bears and bulls out there, the dollar really is almost set on doing nothing. At least that's the case since the start of the year. What do you think is the next big move for the dollar and how does this play out?
Well, look, Patrick, we are in clearly a consolidation range here between 89, which is a key support level, and 92, which was the previous support level, now resistance. A confirmed breakdown below 89 at a daily close below that level, better yet, a weekly close below that level, could unleash a tsunami of selling and take us much lower. But frankly, we don't know that yet. We're in the middle of a consolidation range, and for all we know, we could spend the next 2 years trading sideways in that range. So from a technical perspective, we're just, trading sideways until further notice, until we get either an upside or a downside signal, which I don't see any sign of yet. Meantime, remember, the clear call here from a fundamental perspective is that all fiat currencies are going to devalue in purchasing power as a result of fiscal and government policies around the world. But the dollar index is relative. It's just a question of whether we're recklessly printing and devaluing money faster or slower than other governments around the world. Don't underestimate Christine Lagarde's ability to be reckless and irresponsible, just like Janet and Jerome.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil because the last 3 months has just been straight up rip higher. We finally saw crude oil printing north of $60, approach 62. Bit of a reversal day today off of those highs, but still a very pronounced uptrend. How do you interpret this? Is there more upside or is this enough for this current advance?
Well, last week I said the logical target for the rally was 60, spot 92, and then I predicted a consolidation would occur for at least a week or so. I got half of that right, to the tick, 60, spot 92. Exactly, I hit my target and then began consolidating. And that consolidation lasted for all of a day or so, and then we just moved higher. The really big news this week, though, came on Wednesday when the market was absolutely crushed by an OPEC announcement that they are reversing their recent decision to extend their production cuts. They're going to start turning up the screws and producing more oil. Market crashed like a rock for a good couple of hours before retracing, and by the end of the session, trading higher than before the news came out. So it seems like this market can shrug off just about any kind of bad news, or at least that was the case for the first half of the week. Now, it seems to me like we're still headed probably much higher. But interestingly, crude oil inventory came in delayed this week on Thursday today, and it was a really big drawdown, 7.3 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 3 million barrels. Gasoline building 672,000 barrels, nowhere close to as big as the gasoline builds have been in recent weeks. And distillates was a drawdown this week, another 3.4 million barrels. So more than 10 million barrels net of petroleum products between crude oil and finished products drawn down. That, of course, was super bullish news. Tape goes straight up. Only for an hour or two. And now, as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon, we've fully retraced down and we're just showing a low on the day, just kissing the five-day moving average at 59.78. I think we're probably just seeing a natural pullback here before a move higher. That certainly has been the trend. But it's interesting that what should have been a fairly bullish inventory report was a catalyst for the market to move higher, but it couldn't sustain it. That rally failed. So maybe we're going to see the beginning of a more significant pullback, but I think there's still higher numbers to come.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because gold the other week tried to bounce, it tried to rally, tried to get toward 1850, and then we come into this week and the selling all over again. We're trading at 1773, right along those November-December lows. Do we have that break to a fresh low here on gold? This downtrend seems relentless.
Well, exactly as I predicted last week, Patrick, I said we have a new channel that has established itself in the gold market, a downsloping channel. We had touched channel support last week and bounced very nicely off of it, and we got up to channel resistance, and sure enough, exactly as we predicted here on Macro Voices, we retraced down to now test the bottom of that channel. Right now, the channel is pretty well established. At the current moment, channel support is 1759. Channel resistance is 1843. Both of those numbers go down every day because it's a downsloping channel. Could be that the double bottom is in. We got what's approximately the same number as we speak right now today at 1773. It's right about where we were on the low print back at the end of November. Is this a double bottom, same number as late November, and it's all uphill from here? Could be. There's a little bit of an argument for that. But frankly, I don't think so. And the reason is that we have increasing real yields. And I don't personally think those are going to be sustained because I think the inflation is coming. And yeah, nominal yields are backing up and they'll probably continue to move higher. That will probably continue to adversely affect the price of gold. Eventually, inflation's going to catch up with it, and we're going to discover that the increasing real yields were really just increasing nominal yields, and the inflation just hadn't been recorded yet. Now, if you don't believe that, if you disagree with the inflationary outlook, and you really think that we still have a deflationary macro backdrop and a deflationary outlook from here, then you have to be a gold bear here, because we do have nominal rates increasing. Anytime that you have increasing real yields, it's always a substantial headwind for gold. It's a not bigger than a headwind. It's a substantial bearish fundamental driver for gold. I don't think that it's going to last. And it's not because I don't believe that the Treasury yields can go higher from here. I think they can, and I think that they will. But eventually, the inflation that is really already happening will be recorded and recognized. And when it is, I think gold is going to have its next very significant leg higher. Question is, how much lower do we go first? I don't know, but we're already into the bargain zone as far as I'm concerned. I have been buying mostly mining shares here, and I intend to buy quite a few more. I have not added to my actual gold bullion position, only because I already have a very large gold bullion position, and I'm a little bit underweight the mining shares now. Once I get my mining allocation up, I'll start adding to my gold position as well as this sell-off continues, and I think it probably does have a ways further to go to the downside. Eventually, I think it'll be a very big bull market.
Now, earlier you were talking about the 10-year yield, or at least yields in general, and let's circle back to that 10-year yield. I mean, for a better part of 6-plus months, the yield was stuck between, you know, 70 basis points to 1%, and it was like watching paint dry. It just we had nothing to say about bonds, and it was just such a boring market. And well, really, since the start of the year, the yield started to accelerate, and this week, a big acceleration to the upside, north of 1.30 on the 10-year yield, at least temporarily got up there. Are we going to now see the rate of change of interest rates accelerate? Like, how do you think this plays out? Is this a real breakout in your mind?
Well, Patrick, this is something I've been pondering, and I want to actually pull Kevin Muir in our post-game segment and get his perspective on this. But the question is, how far up, because clearly there is a driving force right now with all of this expected borrowing that the federal government's going to do to finance trillions of dollars of spending. There's lots of reasons to think that the 10-year rate could go higher. What's the primary thing holding it back, preventing it from going higher? The primary thing that prevents it is the realization that, boy, the U.S. government can't really afford to let it go too much higher. Well, wait a minute. There's a fallacy there. The debt that's already issued is already issued at a coupon rate that's fixed. It doesn't change. That's why they call it fixed income. As the yield goes up, it increases the cost of new borrowing. It doesn't increase the cost of old borrowing. So the question is, if the 10-year or the 30-year yield go up, to what extent does the federal government just finance its deficit spending with shorter and shorter duration treasury issuance? That would be the question. Is, you know, does the 10-year really have to stay at a level where the government can finance most of its operations with new 10-year issues? Or are they going to go to more 5-year issues and look at where the demand is? There's a huge amount of demand at the front of the curve. You know, T-bills are basically yielding nothing. So what's to stop the federal government from covering its refinancing needs with shorter and shorter duration securities? That would be the reason to maybe question this very popular narrative that says they can't afford to let the rates go any farther. If that's true, maybe it means, especially for the 30-year, more so than the 10-year, it really does have plenty of room to move to the upside. I'd love to get Harley Bassman's perspective on that. We should try to get him back on the show one of these days. But meanwhile, we've got Kevin Muir in the postgame segment on this week's show. Let's see what Kevin says after the feature interview.
All right. Well, this week's feature interview guest is Louis Vincent Gav. Now, Eric, why did we bring Louis back this week?
Well, first of all, I want to just let our listeners know we do take seriously the feedback that you're giving us that, hey, guys, you got to get a prominent deflationist in order to balance out all the inflationists you've had on Macro Voices lately. Come on. Yeah, we get it. We agree. The problem is all the smart macro guys and gals that we know have turned inflationist. People we'd really like to get back on the program, Dr. Lacey Hunt, as far as we know, is still holding a deflationary view. We'd love to get an update from Dr. Hunt. We have been in contact with him. He's not available until late spring, early summer. We'll look forward to getting him back as soon as he's available. David Rosenberg, we had on fairly recently. It's a little bit early to bring him back. He is another one who has a deflationary view, last we checked. We're kind of looking for who else we can find that really fits the deflationary perspective. And it's definitely not Louis. He told us that loud and clear at the beginning of this interview. Louis is one of our favorite macro guys, and he also has a perspective perspective on the situation in Hong Kong and where Europe is headed in terms of their monetary policy. So it's a chance to kind of take our conversation international this week. And I think you're going to really enjoy this interview.
Well, Eric's interview with Louis Vincent Gav is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abex Technologies, which also sponsors my new Smarter Markets podcast, which airs every Saturday morning and explores how the markets themselves could be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. My interview with Peter Fusaro, longtime sustainable investing proponent and founder of the Wall Street Green Summit, is available now at smartermarketspod.com and is the first in a series of interviews focused on ESG investing. My guest on Smarter Markets this coming Saturday morning will be Tom Raftery, Chief Innovation Officer for SAP and an outspoken proponent of decarbonization. But you won't get Smarter Markets on your Macro Voices feed. You have to separately subscribe to Smarter Markets in your podcast app to receive this free new podcast.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is GavCal Capital co-founder Louis Vincent Gav. Louis, great to have you back on the show. I want to start with the big one. We've had so many of our top macro experts turn into secular inflationists recently. We're really hoping you're a holdout on the deflation camp.
No, sorry, Eric. No, I'm as big an inflationista as you're going to have on this show, I'm afraid.
Tell us more. Why is that? How do you see it? We've heard quite a few different takes on this.
First of all, thanks a bunch for having me. Happy Shroff Tuesday. And you know what? It's great to be on the show. If I'm not mistaken, the last time you and I spoke was the day that energy prices were negative 40. As we speak today, it seems like you and I are destined to talk when there's massive dislocations in energy. Because as we speak today, obviously you have 4.5 million people in Texas that are cut off the grid, reflecting perhaps underinvestments or malinvestments in the energy space. So maybe I'll start off with that. I mean, you know, when you look at inflation, there's many paths you can go down. But, you know, historically, it's hard to have inflation without rising energy prices, right? Energy, at the end of the day, so much of economic activity, so much of what we do is just transformed energy one way or the other. And, you know, when you look at the energy balance today, what strikes me is we obviously have energy prices that are moving higher and doing so in spite of the fact that most of the world economy is still on lockdown. So the first questions I'd have is, you know, today we have factories going idle for lack of semiconductors. We have houses, 4.5 million households being cut off power grids in Texas for lack of investments in power grid. And I think fundamentally this reflects, it's the other side of the coin of years, I would say, of optimization of everything we've done. You know, we've lived in a world where you could measure everything. And with the ability to measure everything comes a temptation to optimize everything. And, you know, we've the past years have been years of just-in-time inventory and just-in-time production. I wrote a book about this back in 2005 called Our Brave New World. And now I think we're seeing the consequences of this optimization in everything. Last year, we saw the consequence of optimizing our hospital capacity. So countries that had centralized healthcare systems like France and like Britain found that their hospitals were very quickly overwhelmed by a shot out of the blue. Countries like the US that were more decentralized actually tended to cope a little better. And last year, we, you know, got to rue the consequences of years of, in essence, optimization of our healthcare systems. And this year, it seems we're living with the consequences of the optimization of our electricity grid system. All of a sudden, there's, you know, a freak storm, an Arctic blast, although these are not that freak. They do happen every 10 years or so. And lo and behold, lots of people are cut off electricity and the price of electricity absolutely shoots up. And that goes back again to the book I wrote. I don't want to like blog my book overtly, but to the book I wrote in 2005, highlighting that you know, in a world of perfect information, what you have is you have prices that structurally go down and people don't make investments. And then all of a sudden, because of the lack of investments, prices don't go up 1%, 2%. They double, they triple, they quadruple. This is what we're seeing with electricity now. And again, you know, when you consider that so much of economic activity is transformed energy, you know, I think, we've set ourselves up now for some shortages in some very key inputs. Semiconductors, I already mentioned, energy, another one. And yeah, this sets us up for higher prices going forward.
Let's talk about the stock market in the context of this inflation. You know, here we are, the pandemic is not over yet, yet we do have the stock market at all-time highs. Is it the shift to inflation that's driving that? Is it entirely about the Fed? I mean, what's the reason for the stock market being where it is, considering what's going on in the world?
Well, I would say, you know, the first possibility is, you know, it's TINA, what Margaret Thatcher called TINA, right? There is no alternative. In a world in which the central banks are openly telling you, look, I am looking to debase the currency, I will keep real interest rates negative for a very long time. At a time when, you know, you look at OECD government bonds and already negative, you know, real rates are already at -1.5%, -2%, depending on where you pick it. You know, cash is not an option. It's being destroyed over time. Bonds are no longer an option. So, yeah, I think there is the element of there is no alternative. I guess the other alternative, of course, is commodities. And commodities are, by and large, they are moving higher. And that, to me, is another very important element in the investment environment is you pick any commodity today, and they're basically up double digit from where they were a year ago. And we're not having the big base effects kick in yet because, you know, the world really fell apart in March and April and May of last year. So commodities are already up year on year, you know, again, double digits. Come April, May, June, they'll be up just monster amounts year on year. So, you know, against this environment, do you want to own bonds? I don't think so. Do you want to own cash? I don't think so. So, yeah, that leaves you with equities.
Let's talk about bond yields. Just a few years ago, if I had told you U.S. 10-year, 1.3%, most people would have laughed me out of the room saying, that's a crazy low number. It could never go that low. Now everybody's panicking that 1.3% is a high number on the 10-year Treasury. Where can it go from here? How much room do we have for the backup in yields to continue?
Well, I think a lot of that will depend on central bank policy. Central banks at some point, you know, as bond yields inch higher, will have to make a choice of either, you know, fully embracing yield curve control and in essence crushing their currencies in the process, option one, or letting the bond yields go back to more natural levels, but in so doing, you know, really putting pressure on the governments. To put things in context, you know, a 50 basis point increase in the cost of funding for the U.S. government is equal to the annual cost of the U.S. Navy. A 30 basis point increase is equivalent to the cost of the U.S. Marine Corps. So, you know, just you know, we've gone from 50 basis points to 130. That 80 basis points is equal to the Marine Corps plus the Navy together, the annual budget. So, I wish I had the answer, of course, and I'm not trying to duck away. But the simple reality is, it'll depend what central banks decide. Do they do yield curve control and crush their currencies or not? I believe, but you know, I could be wrong. I believe they will do yield curve control, and I believe they will crush their currency. I've been a U.S. dollar bear, as you know. If you remember, I remember the event you hosted in Vancouver, where I believe Juliette and I were the only two U.S. dollar bear on your panel. I've basically been a U.S. dollar bear, partly because at that time, I thought there's no way the Fed can hike again. And even though the market was anticipating, I think, another two or three hikes. Yeah, I think that's pretty much done. But staying on the bonds, I want to make another point, if I may, at the risk of being long-winded. You know, the way I look at assets is that I think there's a life cycle for assets, which can be short, it can be long. But in essence, you know, I've seen this in my career, you know, with Asia. I've seen this in my career with tech. I've seen this in my career with energy. And I think we're about to start a new cycle with bonds where, in essence, you know, an asset starts being contrarian. Let's say, you know, Asia in the early 90s. Then, you know, some investors start to see, well, actually, this asset is delivering pretty good income. So it moves from being a contrarian asset to an income producing asset. And then as it continues delivering income regularly, people start to say, well, this is actually pretty defensive. This is good. And then after that, it can perhaps evolve in becoming a growth asset. And here you have two kinds of growth assets. Growth assets that are sensitive to changes in prices, and i.e. inflation, and growth assets that are sensitive to changes in growth, i.e. their volume plays. And then if you're very lucky, you get re-rated from a growth asset to, I would say, the nirvana of the asset world, which is you're perceived as being anti-fragile. And when you're perceived as being anti-fragile, as basically being the thing you can add in your portfolio that will do well when everything does badly, when you're perceived as anti-fragile, this is as good as it gets. Then everybody wants to own you. And of course, this is, you know, U.S. Treasuries are today the ultimate anti-fragile asset. They're the asset that everybody owns in case there's trouble. They weren't always. In the 1960s and 1970s, U.S. Treasuries were not perceived as being anti-fragile. And the big challenge, of course, when you're looking at this life cycle of assets, is if an asset that used to be perceived as anti-fragile is no longer perceived as anti-fragile, that's the fall from heaven down to hell. And I'm sure you're familiar with Arthur Miller's quote in The Crucible of, before Lucifer fell, God thought him beautiful in heaven. He was the most beautiful of angels until he fell. And so today, I think the big danger is on bonds. They are perceived by the wide majority of investors as being an anti-fragile asset when the entire macro setup is set against them. And if ever the market wakes up to the fact that these assets are not anti-fragile, then it'll be just like Lucifer falling from heaven.
Well, Louis, we've already seen some examples recently of both stocks and bonds moving down in price at the same time, which, of course, undermines the whole theory of the 60-40 portfolio, where the bonds are supposed to hedge volatility in the stock market. With that in mind, how should we be thinking about portfolio construction? Because it seems like 60-40 is kind of not working anymore.
I think that's right. I think, you know, if you look at, you know, basically when the world shut down for COVID in the second half of March last year, equities obviously tanked, which made sense, but bonds also tanked. And that was new. That was the first time in my career that I saw equity fall 20% and bonds actually increase the volatility of your portfolio rather than induce it. And again, in September, October of last year, you had equities, they went down a little bit. They went down 5-6%. And bonds over the same period went down 1-2%. So yeah, no, I do believe that bonds are no longer there. And part of the reasons bond can no longer do their job is, frankly speaking, you know, when you have a bond that yields 1.5% real and a bond that yields -1.5% real, it's not the same thing. You know, I think you and I have discussed this before, but I own a professional rugby team in France called the Biarritz Olympique. And, you know, around this time of year, you put your team together. Now, in a rugby team, everybody's got a specific job, right? You need people of different shapes and sizes. So your props are, you know, short and stout. And they're always ready for a fight. Your second rows are tall and lanky. Your wingers are short and fast and so on. Well, for me, the bonds are like the props. You know, they were basically the bedrock on which you build your portfolio, just like a prop is the bedrock on which you build your scrum. Now, you expect your prop to weigh somewhere between 120 and 135 kilos. The bond for me is the prop that used to weigh 120 kilos, went on holiday, and came back for the start of the season weighing 75 kilos with a flat stomach. Or to put it in American terms, it's the offensive lineman who used to weigh 300 pounds and comes back weighing 180 pounds. Now, the reality is, who needs a 180-pound offensive lineman or a 75-kilo prop? That's what bonds are today when they yield -1.5%. So yeah, what can you do about the fact that you now have, you know, you don't have 120 kilo props anymore? Well, I would say that the first reality of this is if you no longer have an anti-fragile asset to reduce the volatility of your portfolio, you probably need to diversify more than you did in the past and to avoid concentration. That's the first point. The second point I would say is to deploy capital in the places where the currencies are not being debased. And you and I have also talked about this over the years. You know, if anything, you know, the COVID crisis was an acceleration of trends that were already going on, right? The tensions between China and the U.S. being one of them, the debasement of Western currencies being another. And the third being the internationalization of the renminbi and the attempt of Asia to, in essence, de-dollarize their trade. Now, one of the very interesting development of COVID for me is that while we've seen unprecedented expansionary fiscal and monetary policies in the Western world, in Asia, we really haven't seen this. And as a result, you are seeing very, you know, solid strength in a lot of Asian currencies. So clearly, this is now where you want to own your bonds. The new anti-fragile asset is no longer the U.S. Treasury. It may very well be the Chinese government bond or the Korean government bond or the Singaporean government bond and so forth. So today you have to, in essence, you know, with the central bank actively debasing the U.S. dollar, the euro, et cetera, you have no choice but to deploy capital to places where the currencies are not being debased. This is where you'll find your anti-fragile assets. And I would say the third point is, you know, going back to this idea of the rugby team, when you look at the portfolio, when you build your rugby team, everybody has a specific job, just like a football team. You know, you don't expect your quarterback and your football team to do a lot of tackles. You don't expect your running back to do a lot of blocks and so forth. Everybody's got their jobs. Well, the same is true in a portfolio. When you build your portfolio, you should have different pockets. You should have a contrarian pocket, an income-producing pocket, a defensive pocket, a growth pocket, an anti-fragile pocket. And you should be very cognizant of the assets that you put in there. You know, what job do you expect them to do? And you judge them on that job. So if we're in a roaring bull market, then you accept the fact that your defensive pocket isn't going to do that great, and so on and so forth. Today, what's pretty obvious to me when you look at that growth pocket, which is, of course, the exciting pocket, is that the growth pocket is starting to shift from growth from volume, i.e. technology, healthcare, and so forth, towards growth from prices, i.e. energy, material, industrials. And that's a shift that makes sense to me, given the global economic rebound and the rising threat of inflation.
Louis, with the inflation outlook that we've discussed, a lot of people would say, hey, a favorite inflation hedge is gold. But gold's been really pretty darn weak lately. Is that because real rates are rising with the backup in treasury yields? And is that likely to continue and provide more headwinds for gold?
Look, I think it goes back to the idea of knowing what everything you have in your portfolio and what you have them for. If you have gold, why do you have it? You know, going back to this idea that, you know, assets can be contrarian, income, defensive, growth, or anti-fragile. Now, arguably gold, you could say, is an anti-fragile asset. It does well in times of complete dislocations. Having said that, gold is also, for me, it's a bit of a mercurial player. If you're, you know, putting your team together, gold for me is the superstar who you never know who's going to show up. Sometimes it has a great game. Sometimes it has a horrible game. And, you know, sometimes it saves your bacon when things are terrible. And other times it just doesn't do anything for you. You know, talking in rugby terms for your listeners who know rugby, France used to have a fly half called Frédéric Michalak. And he was a genius player. And he could be capable on the day of the worst or the best. Scotland today has a player a bit like that with Finn Russell. You never quite know what's going to happen. And so what we would do with Michalak is usually they'd keep him on the bench until a game was lost. And then you'd put him on and say, well, maybe he can work his magic. And for me, that's what gold is. You have it in your portfolio because every now and then, and it's very hard to know when, it's just going to shine, no pun intended. It's just going to just absolutely do terrific. And you just don't know when. What you do know, however, that it always does badly when either real rates are going up or the US dollar is going up. Now, I take your point that yields have been coming back, but I don't think real rates are going up because nominal rates are going up not as fast as inflation is going to come up. So I still think real rates are actually going to go down. So to me, gold, having some gold makes sense. And you know that when it pops, it's just going to, who knows when it does, but it's just, you know, it's going to be pretty quick. And over 2 or 3 months, it's going to rally like crazy. And then it's going to consolidate, which is what it always does. So it's a mercurial player that you have in your portfolio. And going back to this idea, you have to know what you have everything for. Today, you know, for the past months, you know, November, December, January, February have been pretty good for global equity markets. It's been an environment of, you know, this isn't the kind of environment where gold thrives. You know, why have gold when everything's ripping higher? Yeah, I'm better off owning copper or energy. But if something goes bad, that's when you want the gold.
Let's come back to copper and energy. Why don't we start with energy? As you said, we were speaking on the day that it was minus $40 a barrel for WTI crude oil. Now we're back to the point at over $60, where we're back above the level before the pandemic hit. Now, since that's happened already, while the pandemic's not over yet, does that mean when the pandemic really and truly is over that we're going north of 100? Or does it just mean that the market has already priced in the recovery and that we've pretty much seen the most of the rally?
Look, I'm a bull on energy. I think it's basically the one sector in our system that has been deprived of capital for the past 5 years or so for two reasons. One of them is ESG and the fact that we are trying to transition our economies away from carbon. And the other is that energy was a horrible steward of capital for a period of about a decade. You know, the U.S. shale oil miracle was a miracle that was first and foremost fueled by capital destruction. You know, more than $300 billion was lost in the U.S. increasing its oil production by about 5 million barrels per day. And this is now over. The ability of the U.S. to basically transform capital into energy is now gone. You know, U.S. oil production is down more than 2 million barrels from its high. And I don't see that turning around, frankly, anytime soon, given the amounts that are being invested. You look at, you know, the big U.S. oil companies, Chevron, Exxon, their capital spending budgets are today half of what they were in 2014. So, no, I think we, you know, the big question going back to your first point is, we now have a world where oil prices are going up. So that's the first variable. Does that mean that production is going to turn around from its recent fall? And well, it probably takes 6 to 12 months to get production to turn around, right? It's not like you just turn on the tap and on it comes back. So production doesn't come back that quickly. The big question is, which comes back first, production or demand through reopening? Now, I tend to believe, I'm an ever optimist. I look at, you know, the collapse in hospitalizations in most Western countries. I look at, you know, the fact that winter is soon going to be over. I look at the fact that deaths and cases seem to be rolling over everywhere. And if by the summer we're reopened, which I believe is, you know, it's at least a 50-50 shot that by the summer we're reopened, what I know is by the summer we won't have increased oil production. So if by the summer we're reopened, then what seems likely to me is at that point, then oil prices will have moved higher.
Let's talk about copper, because on one hand, you know, boy, I think this is one of the biggest copper rallies in recorded history. It feels like, you know, it's gone up so far so fast. Surely it must be over. It must be time for it to go down. But then I think about, boy, look at the political changes. Look at the focus on the environment and electric vehicles and the need to build out the electric distribution grid to support those vehicles. It all spells more copper demand. So could this be just the beginning of a major, major move up in copper?
Very potentially. In energy, arguably, you could say, well, you know, if we throw money at it, if the price gets high enough, we have lots of supply coming in. In copper, the equation's tougher. It's, where does all the supply come from? You know, there's been tons of money being spent on exploration for copper over the past 15 years. And it's not like we've had massive finds. It's not like we've had the equivalent of the U.S. shale oil miracle or the Petrobras offshore finds in copper, right? It's the supply just isn't there. Now, you could say there could easily be, of course, some substitution. You know, if copper prices get high enough, you know, we start substituting it for various polymers or whatever else. But yes, to your point, you know, for the whole debate on, oh, we need to electrify our cars. And, you know, I think your average car, electric car, has three times more copper than your petrol car, your combustion engine car. There isn't enough copper to move to a world where all the cars are electric. Not unless we change the way we do the electric cars. So yeah, there's a bottleneck there that will have to be resolved by either changing the way we produce electric cars or resolved by big new copper finds. But we're struggling to find the copper. So yeah, you add it all up. It's like, okay, well, at the very least, you don't want to be short, that's for sure.
Louis, let's talk about Hong Kong. And recently, I interviewed Kyle Bass on the program. He told us he thinks that Singapore is the heir apparent in the sense that Hong Kong is, unfortunately, it seems, losing its independence to China. He thinks as a result, where Hong Kong has historically been the gateway city between Asia and Western finance, Kyle thinks that Singapore is the heir apparent that's going to take that title. Do you agree or disagree, and why?
Well, the first point I'd make is 60% of the world population lives in Asia, and it's the fastest, obviously, growing part. Can Asia have two financial centers? You know, yes, is the obvious answer. I don't see why we have to have an either-or proposition here. What's been very obvious is, yes, China has taken over Hong Kong to make Hong Kong the financial hub that China needs to basically internationalize the renminbi, to become the global power that that it wants to be, that, you know, you and I have discussed many times over the years. And that's already, you know, a very big ask for Hong Kong, a very big task ahead with lots of potential growth from Hong Kong. Now, Hong Kong obviously has been in a political crisis for the past couple years, but this political crisis has absolutely not affected Hong Kong's role as a financial center. You know, to Cal's point, you know, what is the biggest market cap in Singapore today? You know, what is the biggest company listed on the Singapore Stock Exchange? It's DBS Bank, right? DBS Bank doesn't even qualify in the top 50 companies in the world by market cap. If you look at today Singapore and you're a big, big capital allocator, you know, what are the companies? Let me ask you a question. Name me, you know, five major companies listed in Singapore. You'll probably struggle. Where are Alibaba? Hong Kong. Where's Tencent? Hong Kong. Where's NetEase? Hong Kong. Where's JD.com? Hong Kong. You know, it's, I'm not saying that there's no role for Singapore, but come on, let's look reality in the face here. To say that Singapore is going to capture the Chinese business is ludicrous. It's not even close to reality. All the big Chinese listings are happening in one place and one place only today, and that's Hong Kong. If you look at the number of IPOs, the number of debt issues, the number of everything, and this isn't to say bad things about Singapore, but Singapore is nowhere near what Hong Kong is doing in terms of the size of the business, at least in terms of the size of the China business. And this for a very simple reason. You know, let me ask you another question. What's the flight time from Singapore to Beijing?
Longer than from Hong Kong.
Yeah, no, it's almost 7 hours. So, you know, Singapore to Beijing, to put things in perspective, is basically the same thing as going from New York to Paris in terms of timelines. So it's, you know, the old joke is that, you know, the best place to live in India is Singapore. The role of Singapore historically has been to serve as the capital market for India and the capital market for Southeast Asia, and of which there's, you know, there's tons of business there as well. But to think that Singapore is going to become the capital markets for China, I think that's delusional.
Let's talk a little more about where you see Hong Kong headed. Last we spoke, you still had a fair amount of optimism that maybe a lot of people thought worse than it really was, and maybe Hong Kong's independence wasn't really under quite as much threat as some people were saying. Feels to me like things have pretty clearly going in a direction where Hong Kong is, in fact, losing its independence. Do you see it differently, or how should we think about this?
Well, I'm not sure I said that, actually, to be honest, Eric. I think when we had these discussions, my point was always that, look, China is, Xi Jinping is an imperialist president whose aims to really raise China's global footprint, and that he was taking over Hong Kong. I think I was always pretty clear about that, for Hong Kong to become the Chinese financial center that he needs to, you know, for China to become the empire that he imagines it to be. And so the point I think I made on talks with you in the past is that Xi Jinping cannot afford for Hong Kong to be a failure. And this on any front, whether it be a political failure, whether it be an economic failure, whether it be a market failure, basically Xi Jinping has now made the Hong Kong problem his. And anything bad that happens in Hong Kong is now a direct reflection on him. And I think I've made that point, you know, and we've made that point together in the past in discussion. And this was, you know, one of the reasons why I, you know, firmly believe that rather than being bearish Hong Kong, the takeover of Hong Kong by China was at least in the short term, you know, going to guarantee that nothing bad would happen in the Hong Kong markets, because, you know, it would be too much of a loss of face for Xi Jinping if that was to occur. And frankly, I think this is exactly what's unfolding. China has taken over Hong Kong, and they're making sure by, you know, pushing all the Chinese IPOs there, pushing all the Chinese debt issues there, that the Hong Kong capital markets are thriving. Now, over the very long term, yes, that does make for a very different Hong Kong, and one that we can regret and bemoan, etc. But, you know, if we're talking about, you know, financial implications here, I think I tend to believe I was always fairly clear that, you know, Hong Kong was being taken over by China, and that meant that China would now be the guarantor of Hong Kong's financial stability.
Let's move to Europe next, another place where you have a lot of ties. Feels to me like, you know, so many people are just focused on the Fed and Janet Yellen taking over the Treasury, and oh my gosh, look at how much money they're going to print in the United States, and surely it has to mean dollar down relative to other currencies. And I kind of feel like, hey, wait a minute, let's give Christine Lagarde credit where it's due. I mean, it's not like Janet and Jerome have a monopoly on money printing. So what do you think comes next from the ECB in terms of their policy? And what do you see next in terms of Europe, in terms of both monetary and market outlook?
I'm not going to give Christine Lagarde any credit. Printing money when you're a central banker is really not that hard nor complicated, nor does it take much courage, as Ben Bernanke wrote in his book. In fact, it's sort of the default position nowadays. So I don't see why we should give Christine Lagarde any credit for that. Look, I think in Europe, what we now have is a fairly clear situation where you have, which, you know, the U.S. is getting into as well, where you have increasing amounts of debt funded by money printing, and this debt, in essence, funding transfer payments that are completely unproductive. So, you know, this basically system can hum along as long as one of two things don't happen. The first, of course, is that you don't have a currency collapse. Now, how do you know when you have a currency collapse? Well, it'll most likely be a collapse against commodity prices. So if all of a sudden, you know, what could bring an end to all this is that commodity prices rise meaningfully, and especially energy and food, because, you know, if copper goes up a lot, how much copper do you and I consume every day, right? Not a whole lot, but we consume a lot of energy and a lot of food every day. Food, especially me, I do consume a lot of food. So that's the first challenge. And that brings me to the second thing that could unravel everything. And I think the part that perhaps people are underestimating today is the level of anger that is underlying in Europe today. A level of anger that, you know, you saw in the U.S. explode last year, both through the Black Lives Matter and through the Trump movement and the Capitol and everything else. You saw that level of anger explode in the U.S. You haven't seen it explode in Europe. Now, you know, in Europe, rioting tends to be fairly seasonal. It happens either in the spring or in the fall. In the summer, we're on holiday, and in the winter, it's too cold outside and miserable to go out and riot. I think this spring is a very dangerous spring for Europe, in that you know, people are sick and tired of being confined. The confinements in Europe have been way more onerous and pervasive than they have been in the United States. And so there's I think there's a level of anger, resentment in the general population. Now, if you throw on top of that rising food prices and rising energy prices, which we may very well have by this spring and this summer, you know, this potentially is a problem that money printing won't fix. In fact, it's a problem that money printing may exacerbate rather than fix.
Louis, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, tell us a little bit more about what you guys do at GavCal and how people can find out more about what you offer.
Sure. Well, you know, thanks for the plug. You know, GavCal, we're a small financial company. We're owned just by the people who work in the firm. The firm does really three main things. We started off as a research firm, so we publish research for large institutional investors. Here we have different research products. We have a global research macro product. We have a China macro product. We have a Chinese technology research product. We have a Chinese corporate due diligence business. So that's our research arm. We have a money management arm where we manage money for both institutions and private clients under different names. So institutions, it's under the GavCal Capital name, and private clients, it's under the Evergreen GavCal name. And then we have a third business where we basically publish financial software and portfolio construction tools under the name of GAFCAL Intelligence Software, and publish actually we've started publishing a newsletter on portfolio construction aimed more at a sort of more retail client base. So if you're interested in that, you can go to the GAFCAL Intelligence Software website. And yeah, so those are basically the three activities that that we have.
Louis, it's always great to talk to you. I look forward to having you back in a few months for another update. Patrick Serezna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Run your operations like a well-oiled machine with SS&C IS. Automate daily tasks, eliminate manual processes, and minimize risk. SS&C IS has been providing award-winning solutions backed by unparalleled client service for over 25 years. Today, they're helping 1,900 hedge funds, family offices, and asset managers transform their investment process and grow their business. SS&C IS delivers cutting-edge cloud, mobile, and on-premise solutions to maximize efficiencies across the entire investment process for all asset classes. Their solutions are easy to use with friction-free integration into your downstream systems. Meet investor, regulatory, and due diligence requirements, all while lowering cost of ownership. Set your business up for rapid growth and download their free guide at ezsoft.com/macro. That's ezsoft.com/macro.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
So, Eric, that was a great interview with Louis. I mean, I understand a lot of his key inflation narratives. And so we chose to invite Kevin Muir, the macro tourist, on for our post game. How you doing, Kev?
Great. Good to be with you guys.
Kev, you got to be a deflationist. We're looking for one, and we're looking bad.
You got the wrong guy. You got the wrong guy.
So Kev, you had the chance to listen to the interview. How did your inflation expectations differ, or do you have any other views or anything to add to the way that Louis approached it?
Well, Louis gave a great interview. Apart from being one of the world's nicest guys, he's actually one of the smartest with all of his, you know, beliefs that we're going to head higher in terms of inflation. One of the things that I kind of view a little differently than Louis, or at least I emphasize a different portion of it, is that I really look at this current COVID kind of realization. And Lynn Alden talks about this change from monetary dominance to fiscal dominance. And I think that's a great way of describing what's transpired. And I think that it is, in essence, the crux of all the decision-making that you need to make in terms of your portfolio. So in 1981, Volcker came and he broke the back of inflation by, you know, using monetarism to raise rates and to stamp out inflation. At the time, very few people believed that he could do that. There was actually a whole crew of kind of strategists who thought there was no way that inflation would ever go down. And yet he did it, and he set off the next kind of 40 years of disinflation and lower interest rates. And the thing about it is that during that period, we relied on monetarism almost exclusively. If you think about every single kind of economic hiccup that we ran into or financial hiccup, it was met with easier and easier money. So we relied on you trying to encourage the private sector to take more and more debt until we finally hit this period in 2008 where the private sector wouldn't take any more debt. And at that point, we needed to go and do unconventional monetary policy to try to encourage the private sector to take more debt and do credit creation. And it didn't work. It didn't work anywhere near as much as we thought it would. There was all sorts of people that were screaming how we were going to have a hyperinflation from quantitative easing, yet it never showed up. Lots of reasons for that, but the main one was that we didn't really understand how it worked. Now comes along COVID in 2020, and instead of trying to fix it with pure monetarism again, with lower rates, we take a kind of two-pronged approach. And in fact, not only is it two-pronged, it relies more heavily on the fiscal side. And much to everyone's surprise, the economy does better than they would expect. Markets do better than they expect. And now we have a situation where, you know, the politicians have got a little taste of how much they can spend and how many holes they can fix on the economic side. And if we think about going forward, if this continues, I think that we've laid in the groundwork for, instead of 4 decades of disinflation, 4 decades of inflation, as the politicians use fiscal policy more and more till the point where they actually create inflation.
I guess that's pretty much in line with Louis, but I mean, he had the view, obviously, that the dollar being outright bearish was a big aspect of that. I mean, are you generally bearish the dollar as well in this whole narrative?
Yeah, and the trouble with all these narratives right now is that they're stretched. And you see a situation where everyone's been leaning on the dollar, they've been buying risk assets, and they've been selling bonds. And one of the things that I would like to stress is that I call it the difference between reflation and inflation. So far, I think most of the people, the investors that have been participating in this, have been based upon the idea that we're going to get reflation. So they very much believe that we're going to go in the Fed's, between the Fed and the Treasury, in terms of the fiscal side, we're going to see more spending and more QE, and that's going to reflate the things. But they are very much kind of believing that at the moment that inflation comes back, that we're going to have a withdrawal of the fiscal, and we're going to have the Fed once again raising rates. And it's at that point that this reflation is going to go into inflation. And that is really the crux of the matter. And when I think about the issues facing investors for the next kind of year or two, the real question you should be asking yourself is, when we have this moment of truth, when we have all of the everyone that wants a jab in their arm has got it, we got the economy reopening and everything's flying, do you believe that the fiscal, deficit hawks are going to come back and withdraw spending? Do you believe that the Fed's going to raise rates and snuff it out? And if you believe those things, then very much you should be buying U.S. dollars, you should be buying bonds, and you should be selling risk assets, because those will be the right trades. If, on the other hand, you believe that this has kind of been a political shift and that fiscal spending is here to stay, and that Biden and all the new governments are very serious about going and actually trying to, do infrastructure spending and continuing with their fiscal push. And if you believe the Fed when they say, no, we're going to let things run hotter, we're going to do this average inflation targeting, and we're going to not worry about it when inflation goes to 3 or 4%, we're going to not snuff it out. If you believe all those things, then I'm with Louis in that he says that these bonds are going to, what was his line? They're going to go from heaven down to hell. I like to say that the bonds are going to turn into the ballast for your equity portfolio, to the anchor. And that's what I worry about going forward.
Right. So one of the reasons we invited you out to the post game was a recent macro tourist article you put out there about the coming TGA account tsunami. And you're saying that Yellen has finally given us a roadmap to this TGA unwind. So why don't you take us through your narrative and what you see there?
Sure. So the Treasury General account is, you can think about it kind of like a checking account for the U.S. government, the federal government. And for many decades, it was zero. They just, when the government spent, and they might have a little bit in reserve, but the moment they spent, they would go out and borrow. Well, then what happened was the great financial crisis came, there was all sorts of issues, and all of a sudden, Obama and that government realized that there was times that they should go out and they should actually have a balance in this account. So this account that had previously been zero, next thing you know, it's $300-400 billion. And what that means is that the government is gone and pre-borrowed money, meaning that they've gone out and raised money by issuing T-bills or issuing bonds, and yet they haven't spent it. And if you think about it, it's like when you go out and you raise money, you withdraw the liquidity from the system, yet the benefits that the economy experiences when you expend it haven't actually been experienced. So this mismatch in timing, as this account got larger and larger, became a greater role in the markets. And one of the things that happened in actually the Trump administration, there was going into the kind of handoff from Obama to Trump, this TGA account was almost $400 billion. And then what happened was when Trump and Mnuchin got it, they drove it down to zero in the space of two months. And that was in 2017. So from 2017, January to March, they proceeded to basically unleash that, you know, $300 billion into the market or into the economy. And that actually caused the stock market to rally. And if you look at this TGA account, even into 2017 and 18 and 19, as Trump and Mnuchin moved it up and down, it actually also affected the stock market or risk assets, you know, more than people understood. Now, fast forward to the COVID, what happened was that Trump and Mnuchin, they went and they put the TGA up account to an unheard of $1.6 billion, meaning that they went out and raised trillion. I'm so used to the billions, I'm missing the trillions. It was $1.6 trillion. So they raised all this money, so they actually sold all the bills, and yet they didn't spend it. And there were some people who thought, oh, he's such a genius, Mnuchin. He's going to go and he's going to spend all this and he's going to run it down right in front of the election and help his boss by, you know, goosing the stock market and goosing the economy. Well, it turns out that he wasn't such a genius and he was just bumbling around like the rest of us, you know, during this whole debacle. And now all of a sudden he hands it off and the new administration gets this and they have $1.6 trillion. So Janet Yellen is the new Treasury Secretary. And for the first time ever, she's given us a roadmap in terms of this account. She's told us that over the next 2 months, they're going to run it down by $800 billion. And then over the next 2 months after that, they're going to run it down so that it's back to $500 billion.
If anyone has my confidence to spend upwards of $1 trillion, regardless of whether there's anything that needs to be bought, Janet gets my vote.
So now, Mark Cabana is the Bank of America rate strategist, and he has this great interview on Bloomberg TV where he went and walked us through the numbers. So he says between the ongoing Fed QE and the U.S. Treasury of rundown of the TGA, we're going to see $1 trillion of bank reserves added to the system over the next 2 months. And then by the end of June, we're going to see a total of $2 trillion. So to get kind of some perspective on that, currently there is $3 trillion in the banking system. So it's going to go up by 25% in the next 2 months, and then almost 66% by the end of June. And this is going to have a really perverse effect in that it's going to cause the short end of the yield curve to go down in yield. Because all of a sudden, we're going to have too many banking reserves in the system, and they're going to go out and they're going to buy all the treasury bills and everything at the lower end. And when they do that, there's a chance that we might see T-bills slip into the negative territory. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the Federal Reserve doesn't want that. They don't want negative rates. It messes up a lot of things. So there is kind of a lot of speculation amongst kind of the bond plumbing geeks that we're going to see what's known as an increase on the interest on excess reserves at the March meeting. So this is just fascinating. There's so much liquidity going into the system that the Federal Reserve might actually have to raise rates in March to stop rates from going negative. So what does this mean? First of all, you should be prepared for this kind of, like, let's say, sticker shock of higher rates. A lot of people will look at it and say, oh, geez, that means the Fed's raising rates. They're worried about inflation. Nothing can be further from the truth. They're raising rates because there's this massive amount of liquidity entering into the system. What else might happen? You might see the yield curve steepen. I would argue you're going to see a lower U.S. dollar. And on the whole, I'm a big believer that quantitative easing and TGA kind of liquidity expansion causes risk on assets behavior. So I think you're going to see stocks going up. Now, it's not quite, you know, as most things in the market, it's not that easy. I think you could see a situation where the higher rates from the long end actually scare some of the kind of big, large cap growth stocks. So you might also see a huge rotation out of the kind of the winners of the last year and into things like financials and energy and other kind of value names.
Kevin, in related news, Zoltan Pozsar, the Credit Suisse analyst, used to be with the Fed, who a lot of people have a huge amount of respect for, has been talking about what I think is a closely related phenomenon and saying that there is a risk again on the repo market. So how does what Zoltan's talking about and repo market risk relate to this whole TGA account event that you're talking about?
So Zoltan's talking about the exact same thing the Cabana's talking about at Bank of America. It's that you're going to get all this liquidity at the front end. And if you think about it, what it means is that there's not enough collateral for the amount of money in the system. And that's what he's warning about, in that when there's so much money attempting to, you know, be put to work, that we're going to have a shortage of collateral. And how it manifests itself is, you know, Zoltan's a lot smarter than me. I don't know how it is, but I do know that a lot of people should spend the time to understand what this TGA means. They should spend the time to understand how much liquidity is coming down and then be ready for it, because the last thing you want to do is be surprised by this, you know, monumental move that I think we're about to see.
So let's translate this to what it means for our listeners. One effect of this is if you want to buy T-bills, you better be prepared to not get any yield on them. But what does this mean in terms of transmission risk or event risk? You know, what could go wrong? What could go bump in the night as a result? I mean, usually, you know, too much money in your bank account usually is not a bad thing.
Well, you're right. But we've seen before when strange things happen, like you wouldn't think the GameStop going up would cause the stock market to sell off. Yet it did, because what happened was there was some people on the wrong side of that trade in terms of hedge funds, and they degrossed. Now that degrossing only lasted for a week, and then it was met with more buying. But one of the things that we have to understand is that when we start dealing with numbers that are this big and so huge, and we're just unleashing this torrent of liquidity, you don't know, you don't understand what potentially could happen, because we've never done this before. This number of having a TGA account of $1.6 trillion is just insane. And it's beyond me why Yellen is going and drawing it down over such a short period. It's almost like they don't really understand the financial plumbing as much as we think they do.
That, or it's just as simple as they've got money burning a hole in their pocket, and certain people just have to spend it if they've got it.
I guess so. But they don't, you know, it would still be there. So, and after this, they're going to then have to go and borrow for it when they spend again. Anyways, I just think that it's insane and that they should be careful about it. You should be aware of it. And there's lots of chances for some high volatility. One of the things that you should think about is that right tail risk on some of these risk on assets. It wouldn't surprise me at all if we see a situation where stocks, as crazy as they are, have been, get even crazier to the upside.
So we see crazy melt up. I agree with that. I think we're well on our way into a crack up boom anyway. So that very much jibes with my view of the world. Let's talk about where the Dow, obviously, if you're short this market, you're in trouble. But aside from that, what do people need to be worried about? You know, when we talk about right tail risk, prices could go up a lot quickly. Most people don't mind that too much. What can go wrong here?
Well, I think one of the things that you should watch for is the bond market. Like, everyone is getting all excited because the bond market has backed up a little. Like, I look at the 30-year and I say to myself, you know, yeah, it's gone from 1% to 2%. But in the grand scheme of things, this is nothing so far. This is very, very little. And so, you know, if you look at the end of March of 2018, we saw that the 30-year bond was 3.5%. In 2014, it was 4%. In 2010, it was almost 5%. So this was during a period when we didn't have any fiscal spending. We didn't have the Fed telling you that they were going to go and do average inflation targeting. And so I look at what the, you know, worries about in the stock market, and I say, you know, the stock market might be scary, but the bond market is even scarier. And I know there's all sorts of deflationists out there that think I'm completely wrong and that we aren't going to see inflation and that it's going to be transitory in nature. But I would push back and say that, you know, it was back in 2011 that we had all of the worry about the quantitative easing was going to cause hyperinflation. And there was that open op-ed, you know, on the Wall Street Journal to Ben Bernanke about how all this quantitative easing was going to lead to runaway inflation and, you know, a collapse in the U.S. dollar. and there was all sorts of professional money managers that were positioning for the end of the world and an increase in inflation. And yet it almost feels like this time it's the Fed that's telling you that they're going to make inflation and no one believes them. Like, I think that you're going to see a point where all of a sudden that we get inflation take off and the Fed doesn't do anything. And then there's an aha moment in the bond market or in the markets in general. And they're going to be like, oh, my gosh, the Fed was actually serious. And it's that moment that actually really scares me. And so I look at the bond market at 2%. And yeah, could the deficit hawks come back? Could the spending get reined in? And could we go back to 1% for sure? But also, could we have just an absolute crack up to 3-4%? I equally think that that's a possibility, and it's something that very few people are prepared for. And I always find, Eric, that the biggest kind of surprises are the things that no one is expecting, the things that few have hedged for. And I would say that, long end going to 3-4% is something that very few market participants are expecting.
Now, let's talk about that specifically in the context of a narrative that you hear a lot, which is, look, they can't let rates go up because it would bankrupt the federal government. They just can't let it happen. Well, hang on. How much of the federal government's debt is really being issued in terms of new issuance on 10 and 30-year bonds versus shorter-term bonds? And is it really true that they can't let the 10-year or the 30-year go up that much? Or is it just the short end of the curve that they have to keep down in order to not bankrupt the U.S. government?
You're spot on, Eric. And if you think about it, we're just talking about how the short end might go negative because there's so much liquidity in the system. And that's kind of the irony of this thing, is that they're putting so much liquidity that you're seeing a situation where the short end is zero and in danger of going negative. Meanwhile, the long end could go, in essence, no bid, or at the very least it could get repriced. And so I'm 100% in your camp that those who say, oh, the Fed's going to step in and do yield curve control, or that there's no way that they're going to allow the long end to, go that far higher in terms of yields, I don't think they care. And in a lot of ways, if you think about it, it's beneficial for the economy to have a steep yield curve.
Well, and I think it also sets up a potential trap further down the road, because I could imagine easily that the Fed lets the back end of the curve really go up quite a bit, 3-4%, and they keep the front of the curve much lower, and they just issue a lot more short-term debt. In other words, they're selling the debt where the demand is at the front end of the curve. And, they're all just happy-go-lucky with, we can keep things going, we can keep things going. This is exactly the same mistake that all of those subprime borrowers made, getting into mortgages that were being refinanced every year. And, of course, you're never going to have the event where it gets refinanced in a way that doubles my payment and I can't afford it overnight. That could never happen. I mean, they would never let that happen. Of course, they never say who they is.
Right.
What happens if the federal government makes that same mistake and issues most of its debt really short term, and rates just don't go up and don't go up and don't go up until they do one day? Then what happens?
Listen, you're like four steps down the kind of path. I don't think that anybody thinks that far ahead. Like, let's face it. We just talked about how Janet Yellen's going to spend, $1.6 trillion over the space of 4 months. Like, to think that they have a grand plan is foolish. They're not. It's just often one fire, putting out one little fire to the next. But one of the things, though, I have said for the longest time, Eric, is that before this is all through, the yield curve will go to record wides, meaning that the difference between the long end and the short end will hit levels that we've never seen before. And it will be because the Fed will say, we're not raising rates because there's too much debt. People, they'll say they're doing it for the benefit of the consumer or the private corporations, but maybe they're doing it for the government. But on the whole, they're just going to do it because it makes sense to keep it low. And then what you're going to see is the long end says, hey, wait, this means there's going to be a lot more inflation. And we're going to see a situation where we could see, the 2-year at 1%, and maybe see the long end at 6-7%. That wouldn't surprise me at all before this is all through if that's what we end up with. Now, a lot of people will say, oh, no, they're going to do yield curve control way before that. I don't buy that they're going to do yield curve control. When you listen to them, they don't tell you that they're going to do it. And I, as I said and explained before, if you think about it, we're having a trouble with, you know, too much speculation in the stock market, too much financial asset prices are going too high. So therefore, why would we be against having real rates at the long end go back up? Like, well, why is this such a bad thing to have the long end, you know, higher in terms of people can actually earn a yield again? So I'm a seller. I think that they're gonna let it go. And if it does come, it's going to come from much higher levels. And so when I think about the real risks out there, I think that it's going to be the bond market is the scariest portion of your portfolio.
So Kev, thank you so much for joining us. So listen, if all of our listeners want to follow your work, where can they find you?
You can go to themacrotourist.com. I write there. I call it the almost daily. It's not quite even almost daily these days. But if you're interested, make sure you shoot me an email, kevin@themacrotourist.com. I'm happy to kind of forward you off a couple of the recent pieces. Thanks for having me on, guys. It's always a blast.
Absolutely. And on top of that, this article on the TGA account had some great graphs on it as well. And that's anyone who accesses it can get and read this article in greater detail. Anyway, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by SS&C EZ, delivering cutting-edge cloud, mobile, and on-premise solutions to optimize operational and investment alpha across the entire investment processes. Listeners, if you haven't yet taken advantage of a free subscription to our Research Roundup email newsletter, please do so. You can do that by clicking the red button that says Looking for the Downloads on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Patrick, tell them what they're missing in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, and as well as there's a link to a variant perception report on the next commodity super cycle, and also a link to a Howard Marks interview about the biggest risk is rising interest rates. And so you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, and that's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.